This is Phil Farron, and I am driving to the hospital again this week. Oh, this has been a saga. And as recently as yesterday, it's a little cold in the car, and I don't have any gloves. I wasn't paying attention to the weather. We're having a small little cold snap here. It's still not bad for the middle of January. Towards the end of January, actually. So, I mean, we are on the downside of this now. Yay, spring is coming. But it's a little chilly. Anyways, just as recent as yesterday, day before yesterday, we were ramping up. We were making preparations for a funeral. Because my father-in-law, we call him Papaw. Papaw was just, he was not good. And one of the doctors had come in and said, well, you know, we've pretty much done everything we can do, and we're just going to send you home to hospice. And they had already expressed their wishes to not have any kind of big extraordinary care, and, you know, okay, so we were set on that track and heading that direction, and his clinician, his gastro whatever doctor, hadn't come in, and so I guess he finally came in yesterday morning. And they got to talking, and he said, well, I thought you were getting better. I don't know how all those lines of communications work. So he said, well, let's get another CAT scan, and let's find out what's going on. And, you know, we've got things we can do. So today, one of the things they can do is they took him down, and they did the CAT scan, but then using the CAT scan, they went in and used needles and went in, and they, from what my wife told me, if I got it correctly, they extracted 5 liters of fluid buildup in him. So, you know, that's going to make him feel better, which I just called my wife, and she said, yeah, he's feeling much better. So, you know, who knows where this is all going to go, but it was a pretty, you know, we were getting ready to do the thing, you know, and it's just interesting. I mean, not only is the next 4 years going to be interesting because of the political situation and because of tons of other stuff that's going on in the world, in the next 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, sometime in there, both Lynette and I are expecting to lose both of our parents. Well, lose. We won't misplace them. Both of our parents will cross over. Let's put it that way. But step at a time. You know, it's a step at a time. And the whole time, you know, we were facing this down, we were just talking to each other, and I was telling my beloved, I'm going to walk with you through this. You know, this is going to be painful, and this is going to hurt a lot, but we're going to get through this. And so it's, you know, it kind of puts some things in perspective when you get close to these types of things. But we'll see. We're not really sure at this point what is going to happen. Anyways, work was good this week. Got a lot of good stuff accomplished. Always like that. Gonna start ramping up for our first project here just real soon. I've been in this new K2 business process management system. I've been building infrastructure tools. And so that I'd be ready to hit the ground running, I've been needing to have a couple of more conversations to just nail down some details, but everybody has been horrifically busy with end of year, beginning of year stuff, with all the tax filings and everything else that have to be done. So, in light of that, I've been just working on some other things, but we'll get going in February, and I may just go ahead and mock up some prototypes in this coming week, because they won't be done until, you know, we've got to get cash receipts closed, and then we've got to close down the departments, do their month ends, and so they won't be ready to go till second week of February. So next week, I'll probably start putting together a prototype for them. It all goes well. The writing goes well. Things are slowly starting to resolve as to where we're going. This weekend, I think this weekend, I should hit 100,000 words. By Saturday night, should be 100,000. 100,000. Is that right? No. I don't know. Yeah, because I was at 90,600 last Saturday. So, yes, it should be 100,600 by Saturday night. Obviously, there's been a few little distractions. I'm about 500 words down, but not too bad, and I'm in a fast writing section, so I'm going to run down and see Papa in the hospital, stay for a few minutes, and then I'm going to head home and upload the podcast, and then sit down and try to pound through 1,000 words tonight, which tonight on a Thursday night is only 500 words, because I usually only have about an hour, but Lynette will be with her dad, and so we won't have our talking time, and so that'll give me an extra hour, so we'll see. If I can get 1,000 words pounded down tonight, then I'm back on track. And it's interesting. It's like I said, the fog is lifting a little. We're getting there. We're getting there. We'll just see how this works out. There's a few plot details that I don't have resolved yet, but that's okay. They'll get resolved when I get to them. Today, I have just been, you know, kind of watching all the stuff that's going on and just, wow. I'm just impressed again at the amount of subjectivity there is in all of us, in how we arrive at conclusions and we arrive at judgments of others. And, you know, it's only been a week, but there is a lot of stuff going on. This is very interesting. And so maybe, I guess one of the things that really caused me to start thinking about this again is, I think I had mentioned that Ashley Judd did a TED Talk, and I was thinking about talking about it, excuse me, on the podcast, because what she has endured is just ridiculous. It's just crazy. But then, of course, they had the Women's March after Trump was sworn in as president, and Ashley Judd, I guess, got up, and I haven't watched it yet, and gave a kind of rambling poem that parts of could only be characterized as spiteful, which is a shame. You know, I can understand how someone would get there with what she's had to deal with in life and what Trump represents, et cetera, et cetera. But, man, you know, unforgiveness. Someone said on Oprah once, and I thought it was great, that unforgiveness is like eating rat poison and then sitting down to watch to see if the rat's going to die. You, yourself, eating rat poison and then sitting down to watch to see if the rat is going to die. And that vitriol and that need to hurt, to injure, to attack. That is not good for the soul. It's just not good. And I was thinking about how we all have these different viewpoints. Years and years and years ago, when I used to try to argue with people, I've long since given that up, about religion and God and all those things. I was having a conversation, it was kind of a round table conversation with several people on the discussion board, I think it was, and I was talking about how everyone is subjective, how everyone manufactures facts to fit into their viewpoint and just glosses over certain things. And the response I got from one guy who was absolutely adamant, he was adamant, no, I'm fully objective in my life. I am always objective. I only look at facts. I am objective. I mean, he just kept, you know, and I kept trying to make points here and there. And then finally he just said, well, you know, you really don't have, you can't even participate in this conversation because you've already admitted you're subjective. Therefore, you don't even know what objective is anymore. So you can't even tell if I'm being objective. Okay. In other words, stop talking. You're making my objectiveness feel from subjective. Yeah, okay. Okay, got that. Moving on. But it really is because we have this subjectivity that we all bring to our lives. That then engenders blind spots. And people sometimes get really angry when you point out blind spots. I came across an article. Oh, it's been several months now. I've had it bookmarked for a while, and I've just thought, oh, maybe. But, you know, it's a really good article. And it specifically is dealing with feminist myths that will not die. But you could extend these same principles to a host of other things. I don't know if you have heard the old saw that we only use 10% of our brains. That is not true. My understanding is that came from some experiment that some guy did where he like kept cutting pieces of rat's brain out or something like that until the rat got to the place where it couldn't function anymore. And so he'd cut out 90% of the rat's brain. So therefore, we only use 10% of our brain. And that's the problem with studies. Studies can be weak. They can be inconclusive. But if people aren't paying attention, the study gets published and just the headline gets picked up and everybody runs with it. And now suddenly everybody's quoting from this study when the study didn't even say that in the first place. This happens all the time. And mostly what's happening in these myths is that type of thing. There are sporadic studies that then get lumped together and get made to say what they never said, etc., 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 etc. So this is not, I'm not doing the podcast on this article simply because I want to attack feminism. But the mechanism that's going on here, the desire to have a certain viewpoint be correct, the desire to gather the facts that will line up so that they will prove what we want to prove, that mechanism is very much alive and well. And it is alive and well in all of us. And we have to be very, very careful. So I just offer these as interesting examples of this phenomenon and quickly add that this can apply to pretty much any viewpoint that you want to take in any kind of ist that you want to stage. You know, feminist, maleist, whatever, etc. Okay, racist, sexist, blah, 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 blah. So anyways, this article is called Feminist Myths That Will Not Die. It's by Christina Hoff Summers, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of several books, including The War Against Boys. She has a weekly video blog called The Factual Feminist. I should hasten to add that this article was printed in Time magazine. So this isn't some fringe. This was in Time magazine. So she started going through these myths. Myth one. Women are half the world's population working two-thirds of the world's working hours, receiving only 10% of the world's income, and owning less than 1% of the world's property. She said, this injustice confection is routinely quoted by advocacy groups, the World Bank, Oxfam, the United Nations. She said, it's a sheer fabrication. More than 15 years ago, Sussex University experts on gender and development repudiated the claim. Quote, the figure was made up by someone working at the UN because it seemed to her to represent the scale of gender-based inequality at the time. But there is no evidence that it was ever accurate, and it is certainly not today. And then she goes on, and she actually has a bunch of statistics that she quotes and a bunch of studies. So, yeah, not true. Myth two, between 100,000 and 300,000 girls are pressed into sexual slavery each year in the United States. So she says, this sensational claim is a favorite of politicians, celebrities, and journalists. Conservative and liberal reformers both deploy it. Former President Jimmy Carter recently said that sexual enslavement of girls in the U.S. today is worse than American slavery in the 19th century. She said that the source for this figure is a 2001 report on child sexual exploitation by the University of Pennsylvania sociologist Richard Estes and Neil Allen Weiner. But their 100,000 to 300,000 estimate referred to children at risk for exploitation, not actual victims. See, so here we have what is probably a perfectly good study, and someone just lifts out 100,000 to 300,000 every year, sexual exploitation. Boom, now it's out there. She says in this article that when three reporters from the Village Voice question Estes on the number of children who are abducted and pressed into sexual slavery each year, he replied, we're talking about a few hundred people. And this number is likely to include a lot of boys. According to a 2008 census of underage prostitutes in New York City, nearly half turned out to be male. A few hundred children is still a few hundred too many. Granted, we all agree on that, a few hundred too many. But they will not be helped by a thousandfold inflation in their numbers. Myth three, in the United States, 22 to 35% of women who visit hospital emergency rooms do so because of domestic violence. She said, this claim has appeared in countless fact sheets, books, and articles. But she says, where is the provenance? She says, there's no primary source for it. She said, but the editor of Domestic Violence Law cites a 1997 Justice Department study, as well as a 2009 post for the Centers of Disease Control website. But the Justice Department and the CDC are not referring to the 40 million women who annually visit emergency rooms, but to women numbering about 550,000 annually who come to emergency rooms for violence-related injuries. Of these, 37% were attacked by intimates. So it's not the case that 22 to 35% of women who visit emergency rooms are there for domestic violence. The correct figure is less than half of 1%. Myth four. one in five college women will be sexually assaulted. She said, this incendiary figure is everywhere in the media. Journalists, senators, even President Obama cite it routinely. Can it be true that the American college campus is one of the most dangerous places on earth for women? She said, the one in five figure is based on a campus sexuality assault study commissioned by the National Institute of Justice and conducted from 2005 to 2007. She said two prominent criminologists, and she lists their names, which I won't, noted its weakness. They said the estimated 19% sexual assault rate among college women is based on a survey at two large four-year universities, which might not accurately reflect our nation's colleges overall. In addition, the survey had a large non-response rate, with the clear possibility that those who had been victimized were more apt to have completed the questionnaire, resulting in inflated prevalence figures. Because this is what you get into when you're trying to gather facts. You have to be very, very careful. And, you know, if you're inclined to believe something is true, you're inclined when your numbers are coming out the way you want them to come out, it's easier just to say, well, see, that proves it. I'm at the hospital. There's a lady who's parking in a spot that looked like a good spot, so I thought I would wait until she got done in case she was coming out instead of going in, but she's just parking there, so that's fine. I'll drive around here. Hold up. There's a spot here. Oh, hey, there's another one. Okay, I'll go get that one. One moment. I'm not backing into my garage, but I am finding a parking place. Okay. So, the people who were reviewing this last one, they also pointed out that the study used an overly broad definition of sexual assault. Respondents were counted as sexual assault victim if they had been subjected to attempted forced kissing or engage in intimate encounters while intoxicated. Okay, well, that is sexual assault. You know, my thought when I first read this is, as far as, you know, one in five women in college will be sexually assaulted, my very short, probably oversimplified advice to women who are going to college is, don't get drunk around people you don't know. Because alcohol just makes everything worse. The author of this article goes on to say, defenders of the one in five figures will reply that the finding has been replicated by other studies, but these studies suffer from some or all of the same flaws. Campus sexual assault is a serious problem and will not be solved by statistical hijinks. Myth five, women earn 77 cents for every dollar a man earns for doing the same work. Facts. No matter how many times this wage gap claims is decisively refuted by economists, it always comes back. The bottom line, the 23-cent gender pay gap is simply the difference between the average of earnings of all men and women working full-time. It does not account for differences in occupations, positions, education, job tenure, or hours worked per week. When such relevant factors are considered, the wage gap narrows to the point of vanishing. Wage gap activists say women with identical backgrounds and job as men still earn less, but they always fail to take into account critical variables. Activist groups like the National Organization of Women have a fallback position that a woman's education and career choices aren't truly free. They are driven by powerful sexist stereotypes. In this view, women's tendency to retreat from the workplace to raise children or to enter fields like early childhood education or psychology rather than better-paying professions like petroleum engineering is evidence of continued social coercion. Here's the problem. American women are among the best informed and the most self-determining human beings in the world. To say that they are manipulated into their life choices by forces beyond their control is divorced from reality and demeaning to boot. I think that's true. Myth six, last one. Men are the privileged sex. She said, fact, neither sex has a better deal. She goes on and lists a bunch of things, but this is an interesting paragraph. When it comes to being crushed, mutilated, electrocuted, or mangled at work, men are at a distinct advantage. Most backbreaking, lethally dangerous jobs, roofer, logger, roustabout, coal miner, to name a few, are done by men. The Labor Department reports that nearly 5,000 American workers die from workplace accidents each year. 90%, more than 4,400, are male. We are often reminded that only 24 women are CEOs in the Fortune 500. What about the unfortunate 4,400? So she goes on, and in wrapping it up, she says, today's women lobby deploys a faulty logic. In cases where men are better off than women, that's injustice. In cases where women are better off than men, that's life. So final verdict, if Mars needs to check his privilege, so does Venus. Why do these reckless claims have so much appeal and staying power? For one thing, there's a lot of statistical illiteracy among journals, feminist academics, and political leaders. Okay, well, if there's a lot of statistical illiteracy among those people, there's probably a lot of statistical illiteracy among all of us. There is also an admirable human tendency to be protective of women. And what is that? That is subjectivity. Stories of female exploitation are readily believed, and vocal skeptics risk appearing indifferent to women's suffering. Finally, armies of advocates depend on, quote, killer stats to galvanize their cause. But killer stats obliterate distinctions between more or less serious problems and send scarce resources in the wrong direction. They also promote bigotry. The idea that American men are annually enslaving more than 100,000 girls, sending millions of women to emergency rooms, sustaining a rape culture, and cheating women out of their rightful salary creates rancor in true believer and disdain in those who would otherwise be sympathetic allies. That's a very important point. Because it was just what I was talking about before. You know, when you are feeding on things that may not be true, you end up in a place where there is a great deal of rancor and a great deal of anger, and there is a great deal of spite and a needing to hurt and a needing to harm. And there are some resources that will not be willing to come along beside you because they know that's not the path to success. This woman said that her advice to women's advocates, take back the truth. It's a very interesting article. Very interesting article. I have made it to the hospital, and so it's time for me to go inside and check on Papa. My big advice when it comes to all this stuff, if you read something and you feel yourself getting boiling hot or you feel yourself reacting, I think one of the best things you can do is just slow down and take a breath. And if you have the time, get on the internet and just do a bit of looking and see what you can actually find out about what is true. It can be very, very difficult these days to find things that are really true because we are living in a very, very subjective time. But as always, God is good, God is faithful, and it's going to be a fascinating 4 years, and it's going to be a fascinating year this year. This is Phil Ferrand, and I made it to the hospital, and then I'm going home later. Have a great week.